Today is Tuesday, January 26th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Former President Donald Trump's article of impeachment was read aloud in the U.S. Senate.
Donald John Trump engaged in high crimes and misdemeanors.
Plus, emerging signs that the economy is on the road to recovery.
Latest ILO projections for 2021 show most countries will experience a relatively strong recovery in the second half of the year.
And providing Africa's youth with technological opportunities. We'll have these stories and more next. The U.S. House of Representatives sent its article of impeachment to the Senate on Monday.
In his conduct while President of the United States and in violation of his constitutional oath faithfully to execute the office of the President of the United States and to the best of his ability preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States and in violation of his constitutional duty to take care that the laws be faithfully executed, Donald John Trump engaged in high crimes and misdemeanors by inciting violence against the government of the United States.
The trial in the Senate is set to begin the week of February 8th in order to give the lawmakers who will serve as both the prosecutors and the defense for President Trump time to prepare. The extra time will also allow the Senate a chance to confirm some of President Joe Biden's cabinet nominees. A two-thirds majority in the Senate would be required to convict Trump. If he is convicted, a separate simple majority vote could bar him from ever holding federal office again. In addition, the Justice Department's Inspector General also launched an investigation on Monday to determine whether any former or current department officials engaged in an improper attempt to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election. The investigation comes after the New York Times reported that a former Assistant Attorney General, Jeffrey Clark, had been discussing a plan with then-President Donald Trump to oust the acting attorney general and try to challenge the results of the 2020 presidential race. A U.S. voting machine company sued former President Trump's lawyer Rudy Giuliani, accusing him of defaming in what it called his Big Lie campaign about widespread fraud in the presidential election. Dominion Voting Systems Incorporated earlier filed lawsuits against the Trump campaign, including lawyer Sidney Powell, whom the company also accused of spreading false conspiracy theories about the election that Trump lost to Democrat Joe Biden. Giuliani's lawyer did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Trump and his allies spent 2 months denying his election defeat and claiming without evidence that it was the result of widespread voter fraud before his supporters stormed the Capitol on January 6th. Dominion is seeking $1.3 billion in damages. Now, during the United States November election, most attention was focused on the presidential contest between Donald Trump and Joe Biden. But in two states, there was another issue on the ballot, slavery. And VOA's Jason Patinkin has that story.
When people think of the long history of slavery in the United States, they often think the practice ended in the 1860s. But legal forced unpaid labor has persisted since then in one key way. The 13th Amendment in 1865 banned slavery except as punishments for crimes. Now, more than 150 years after the country fought a civil war over slavery, lawmakers in some states are seeking to abolish this last vestige of legal forced labor. In November, abolitionists scored a key victory in the Central Plains state of Nebraska, where 68% of voters approved an amendment to the state's constitution to ban slavery as punishment. State Senator Justin Wayne from Nebraska's largest city, Omaha, introduced the amendment.
Nebraska has a very unique history as being a free state, but we were actually vetoed twice before we became part of the union around racial issues. So we have the felons cannot vote in our constitution. And then I ran across this paragraph that said you could still have slavery as a form of a punishment of a crime. And I just felt like a constitution represents our legal framework and our values. And slavery isn't a Nebraska value.
Within weeks, the Lincoln Journal Star newspaper reported that more than 100 inmates in Nebraska's Lancaster County Jail now receive $20 to $30 a week for their work, laundering sheets, landscaping, and cleaning bathrooms. Before the amendment passed, the inmates did those jobs without pay, the Journal Star reports. State Senator Wayne says he thought of future generations when he proposed the amendment.
So the question for me is, 100 years from now, my great-grandkids are looking at our founding documents of the Nebraska Constitution, they're going to think that we value slavery as a form of a punishment. And so we had to remove that.
But 32% of Nebraska voters opposed the full ban on slavery, some because of concerns it would make it difficult for prisons to hire workers. Wayne says he thinks many who voted against the amendments were confused. By voting no, he says, some people may have thought they were voting against slavery when they were actually voting against the amendment to abolish slavery. Still, Wayne says the fact that hundreds of thousands of people opposed the amendment shows Nebraska continues to grapple with racial issues.
And then I think some of it is just people who, I don't want to say joke around, but just kind of want to go against the grain to go against the grain. But it does overall send a strong message that Nebraska, since our founding days to present, has a racial issue that we still need to address.
The western state of Utah also banned slavery as punishment in November's elections, but 21 U.S. states still allow slavery as punishment, the Associated Press reports, although almost all pay prisoners for at least some of their work. In early December, a group of congressional Democrats proposed to change the 13th Amendment, which Wayne thinks is overdue.
I think it's time for Congress and our federal government to step up to remove that barbaric language. And there's no time to do it like the present.
While outright unpaid labor in prisons is uncommon, many incarcerated people in the U.S. earn just pennies an hour doing jobs such as working in prison kitchens, fighting wildfires, and laboring in prison factories that make clothing and furniture. The Prison Policy Initiative reports that the average daily wage for prisoners is just 86 cents a day. In Nebraska, Wayne says he hopes the ban on slavery as punishment starts a conversation about other racial issues that persist in his state, such as separated school districts and the continued effects of so-called redlining. That now outlawed policy allowed cities to use discriminatory housing and lending policies to prevent black families from moving into white neighborhoods and helped depress the value of black homes.
You know, I think this is the starting point of raising a social conscience about how slavery and its tentacles are still embedded in our society today. And so now what we're going to do in the state of Nebraska is look at how do we address redlining, access to capital for small businesses, procurement, and the overall criminal justice reform as it relates to race and income levels. So I think this is a good starting point, and I think it's a good way for us to start having that bigger dialogue about changes, not just in Nebraska, but across this country.
For abolitionists like Wayne, the fight to achieve racial justice in the U.S. continues. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington.
A court in Uganda has ordered security forces to end the de facto house arrest of opposition leader Bobi Wine, calling it an unlawful and violation of his rights. Halima Athumani has more.
Uganda's High Court on Monday ruled the security prisons at the home of National Unity Platform Party leader Bobi Wine since January 14 was unlawful. Deputy Court Registrar Jameson Karemani read the ruling, which said the detention of Wine and his family was a violation of their rights.
It has been established that his right to personal liberty has been infringed. Having found, as I do, that the restrictions imposed on the applicant are unlawful, it is hereby ordered that they are lifted. Consequently, an order for restoration of the personal liberty of the applicant is hereby issued.
Uganda's state prosecutors had argued that the movement of Wine's wife, Barbara Itungo, was not restricted, which the court found untrue. The state also argued the security forces were at Wine's home for his own protection, a claim that Wine's supporters dismissed as a cynical ploy. The court ruled that if there is a case against Wine, he should be produced before the court. Wine's lawyers, led by George Musisi, applauded the ruling and said they hoped that the state would comply.
We are glad that court has emphasized the constitutional freedoms by saying that the restrictions on personal freedom are so important that if we are to restrain someone's freedom, especially if you're saying that you have grave allegations against them, like they're alleging, they should be taken to court and charged.
Army spokesperson Brigadier Flavia Biekwaso said security forces would respect the court's decision, but indicated they might not withdraw immediately.
That is something we will have to wait for, and that will depend on how the security chiefs determine to do the withdrawal process. To really call upon the other side that really need to keep law. We really need to do less of those things that seemingly cause insecurity. The provocations, the chaos that sometimes cause unnecessary anxiety.
Ugandan security forces surrounded Wine's home as voters went to the polls January 14 to elect a president. After Wine declared the election a fraud and himself the president-elect, security forces moved in on his house and prevented anyone from leaving or visiting, including family. Wine's brother, Fred Sentamu, said they were looking forward to his release.
My brother, Robert Kyagulanyi, didn't commit any crime in standing for presidency of the country. Whoever stands against President Museveni becomes a criminal. This means there is no democracy at all in our country. He has suffered psychologically, physically, he's growing thin.
Uganda's Electoral Commission said 76-year-old President Yoweri Museveni was elected to a sixth term with 58% of the vote, which Wine maintains was engineered by fraud. Uganda's Electoral Commission said it was investigating videos circulating on social media showing people allegedly ticking ballots and stuffing ballot boxes. The U.S. State Department declined to congratulate Museveni and said it remained concerned by reports of election irregularities and politically motivated arrests. Museveni called the election Uganda's fairest ever vote. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Spain has logged a new weekend record of 93,822 new coronavirus infections. However, authorities say that the increase that followed end-of-year celebrations is waning, despite a more contagious variant steadily making inroads in the southern European country. Several Spanish regions continued on Monday, stepping up restrictions on movement and social gatherings. In the United States, President Joe Biden reinstated travel rules on some travelers into the country. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani has that part of the story.
He's reversing an order from the Trump administration's final days that would have eased restrictions starting tomorrow on non-U.S. travelers from Brazil, Ireland, the U.K., and 26 other European nations. He's also adding a country to the list, South Africa, over concerns a virus variant has spread outside its borders.
I believe it's very prudent.
Dr. Anthony Fauci telling NBC's Today Show and other programs the mutation is clearly different and more ominous than one found in the UK. While that one has been detected in the US, the South African variant has not. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Elsewhere, online error messages and jammed up hotlines are slowing vaccine rollout for those over the age of 80 in Germany's North Rhine-Westphalia state. Nationwide, fewer than 1.6 million people, or about 1.9% of Germany's population, have received their first shot by Sunday, a rate far lower than those in Israel, Britain, or even the United States. China is also trying to spread doubt about the effectiveness of Western vaccines and the origin of the coronavirus, as a World Health Organization selected team of scientists is in the city where the pandemic began. Controls imposed on information about the disease by the ruling Communist Party have prompted questions about what the scientists will be allowed to see. And in Mexico, President López Obrador says he has a mild case of COVID-19 as his country registers its highest infections and deaths. The International Labor Organization reports tentative signs are emerging that the world will be on the road to recovery this year from the massive job losses brought on by the COVID-19 pandemic. However, the ILO cautions recovery will be slow, fragile, and uneven. Lisa Schlein takes it from here.
Latest ILO projections for 2021 show most countries will experience a relatively strong recovery in the second half of the year as global vaccination programs kick in. However, ILO Director General Guy Ryder says this optimistic scenario assumes the pandemic is under control and that consumer and business confidence is good.
But even in this case, we expect global working hour losses will continue throughout 2021. With a gap of 1.3% compared to the end of 2019. And that corresponds to 36 million full-time jobs. And in the Americas, Europe, and Central Asia, those losses would be somewhat higher, around 2%.
While signs of recovery are encouraging, Ryder warns working hour losses will continue throughout this year and beyond. He says financial and social distress for millions of people will not be over. The ILO chief notes the latest analysis of the impact of COVID-19 on the world of work confirms how massively the pandemic affected labor markets in 2020.
This has been the most severe crisis for the world of work since the Great Depression of the 1930s. When comparing with the last quarter of 2019, we now see that 8.8% of global working hours were lost in the course of the year. And that is the equivalent of 255 million full-time jobs.
Ryder notes this is approximately four times greater than the number of jobs lost during the 2009 global financial crisis. The ILO reports the majority of these job losses were a result of people dropping out of the labor market because they were unable to work or because of pandemic restrictions. In many cases, it says, people just gave up and stopped looking for work. The report says massive job losses resulted in a loss of $3.7 trillion of global labor market income, or 4.4% of global gross domestic product. It finds women and young people are those hardest hit by the pandemic's labor market disruption. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
It's been 10 years since the revolution in Egypt that overthrew longtime President Hosni Mubarak. Many of those who took part in the January 25th, 2011 uprising in Tahrir Square for 18 days say that most of the core demands of the movement were not met. Egypt has long been ruled by presidents who were army officers warning the Egyptian people that the alternative would be Islamists' takeover. Amy Hawthorne is the deputy director of research at Project on Middle East Democracy, and she discussed the reasons behind failure of democratic transitions in Egypt with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawy.
The original main demand of the revolution was met, and that, of course, was for Hosni Mubarak to resign, which he did after 18 days of mass demonstration. So that one core demand was met. But it's true that everything after that was a big disappointment to many Egyptians who wanted democratic change, social justice, a more open society. There are so many reasons for the failure of Egypt's democratic transition. I would just offer one main reason, I would say, which is that the most powerful and influential political forces in Egypt at the time, that is the Egyptian military and the Muslim Brotherhood, neither of those political forces was a strong and committed pro-democracy actor. Neither the military, which of course was the ruling power in Egypt for 18 months after Mubarak was forced out, or the Muslim Brotherhood, which was the strongest political movement on the ground, neither the military nor the Muslim Brotherhood really used their influence to promote democratic change. And we could say that really neither of them did at all. And in the case of the military, and to some extent the Brotherhood, they actually used their influence and their role to stand in the way of democratic change and block it. So when you have a transition situation as existed in Egypt in February 2011, and the two most influential political actors in the country are both not committed or perhaps even opposed to genuine democratization, you're going to have a very difficult time achieving real democratic change.
Egypt has been ruled for decades by presidents who were military officers, and they have been warning the Egyptian people that the alternative would be Islamist takeover. Why there is no other alternative of civilian, secular politicians or leaders to rule Egypt?
There are two main answers to that question. One is that civilian secular leaders have been divided among themselves about what their political goals are. So we've seen this throughout the history of the Arab Republic of Egypt, that civilian secular forces have not been unified in any meaningful way toward a clear goal of democracy or even any clear political vision. They are divided among those who support authoritarian systems, support the military, or who seek more liberal system or a fully democratic political system. So that division and lack of common purpose among civilian secular forces has been a very notable feature, I believe, of Egyptian political history in the modern era, at least since the time of Gamal Abdel Nasser. And of course, we saw that on display in 2011 and 2012, right after the Egyptian uprising of January 25th, 2011. A second reason is that civilian secular leaders, because of their divisions among them and lack of sort of a clear, organized mass movement, it has been easy for either the regime or Islamist forces at the times when Islamic political Islamists have been the strongest opposition forces on the ground. It's been easy for those groups to sort of outmaneuver secular forces and to keep them weak and to be better at organizing on the ground. So even though secular civilian leaders were the ones who instigated the uprising against Mubarak, who began it and who, I would argue, led it, even though we didn't have clear leaders, but they were at the forefront of the 18 days. They became divided and then weakened in the months and years after Mubarak's ouster.
Amy Hawthorne is Deputy Director of Research at Project on Middle East Democracy. She spoke to VOA's Mohammed Elshenawi. The Haqlab Foundation, a nonprofit organization based in Temma, Ghana, has been empowering youth for future digital careers since 2015. Africa 54's Paul Ndiho spoke to Foster Akugri, Haqlab Foundation president.
Right away, let's start off by maybe you talking about what you do at Haqlab Foundation. You are arguably one of the rising stars in Ghana. You've created a platform that has helped millions of young people who want to get into the technology space. Maybe let's start there.
We live in an equal world where not everyone has the opportunity and access to very, very connected and well-resourced people. Creating a level playing field where there's less bias or is almost absolutely unbiased creates an opportunity for people to compete based on their talents, because talent is equally distributed, but opportunity isn't. And so the purpose of the Haqlab Foundation and my life's mission is to help people find their path by creating that level playing field for them.
A lot of people talk about you as somebody who could be the next Bill Gates or the next Steve Jobs in Ghana. How did you come up with this program here?
Interesting. That's quite a benchmark to compare me to, but I appreciate that I am seen towards that light, and it's positive, so I acknowledge and accept it in good faith. So the Haqlab Foundation started 5 years ago, somewhere in 2015, just as an idea and as a one-time event, which was to bring together innovative students to develop their own solutions with support from a number of tech firms who were now emerging and breaking into the market with fintech solutions. Today, our community has grown to about 10,700 people. We have placed people in jobs. In the last 2 years, we've placed over 700 people in jobs. We have designed a number of other initiatives that is centered around transitioning young people between the ages of 7 to 15 into technology and technology education, into building their careers in technology, and we call that the Hack Lab Junior. And so we want to help expose the young people to technology and kind of give them the opportunity to know what exists.
Let's talk about the other programs that you're working on. Take, for example, AI or artificial intelligence. You're big on that. Help us understand what AI is all about.
This year, we are focused on artificial intelligence. So every year, we choose one of the fourth industrial revolution technologies or the emerging technologies. And all our initiatives, programs, training programs, advocacy, policy, everything we do, hackathons, are focused on that particular theme. In 2021, we are focused on artificial intelligence. Now, the applications of artificial intelligence is currently immeasurable. We can't even tell where and where it can't be used. We'll be interfacing with each other. I will be speaking my Ghanaian dialect, and you will be speaking English. But by the time you finish speaking your English, I have heard it in my local dialect. And by the time I finish speaking my local dialect, you've heard it in English. And it is happening seamlessly. And we are having a conversation as if we were both speaking the same language. And that is the power of artificial intelligence, right? Today, artificial intelligence has broken into things like, it's being applied in things like augmented reality, virtual reality, which is allowing people to experience things firsthand as if they were right in front of them, but they are hundreds of thousands of miles away. And that is what globalization is all about, creating a global village powered by technology, but driven by artificial intelligence. And all these things can only be powerful if we have the right data collection tools. And that is the basis for which artificial intelligence will become the biggest technology we have ever seen.
Well, Foster, thank you so much for your time.
It's always a pleasure.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by visiting voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a terrific Tuesday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Over the past few years, global demand for seafood has far outpaced population growth. The result is overfishing, particularly in easily accessible waters. But as fish stocks become depleted as a result, fishers must travel further out to sea for their catch. Such trips increase expenses like fuel and labor, and some of the less scrupulous operators turn to illegal means of increasing profit. One avenue toward reducing expenses is reliance on forced labor. The fishing sector has inherently high risk for human trafficking, states a new report on human trafficking in the seafood supply chain, jointly submitted to the U.S. Congress by the Department of State and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA. The work is considered hazardous and often relies heavily on a low-skilled, migrant, easily replaced workforce vulnerable to trafficking. This criminal practice is easily hidden because fishing is by its nature isolating. Fishing vessels sometimes spend months or even years at sea. This makes it nearly impossible for fishers in forced labor situations to escape or to report ill treatment. Human trafficking victims are frequently subjected to emotional and physical abuse, which sometimes results in death, extremely long work hours, poor living conditions, and underpayment of wages or outright wage theft. The use of forced labor in the fishing industry is also more likely to occur in politically unstable countries with weak legal protections for civil liberties and workers' rights and high levels of corruption, crime, violence, and poverty. The report therefore recommends that the United States implement four steps toward eliminating this scourge. First, the United States must develop a whole-of-government response to combating human trafficking in the seafood supply chain, both domestically and internationally. Second, The United States should promote and support efforts to combat human trafficking in countries known to have a problem with forced labor in the fishing industry. Third, the United States should promote and support global traceability efforts and engage the fishing industry and NGOs, among other stakeholders. And finally, these steps should build upon and strengthen State Department's and NOAA's existing efforts to address human trafficking in the seafood supply chain. Combating human trafficking in the seafood sector is an important human rights and crime issue, as well as a U.S. foreign policy priority. The new report is an important step in enhancing and coordinating the United States' efforts to combat human trafficking in the seafood sector.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.